history. This show explores the rich heritage of the Brandywine Valley outside Philadelphia, focusing on the people, places, and events over more than 300 years which have played an important part in our American heritage. Each show highlights a local town, event, or personality who's had a notable influence on our culture. And before we get started, I want to mention that our call-in line, if you have questions or comments, is 610-701-9243. That's 610-701-9243. This day in history, April 13th. On this day in 1742, George Friedrich Handel's Messiah debuts in a concert hall in Dublin, Ireland, during the Christian season of Lent. The oratorio meant to inspire people to religious devotion as a sign of their enduring faith. The score would become popular during Handel's lifetime, and in later decades was played as part of the celebration leading up to Christmas. In 1861, after a day-long blistering bombardment by rebel forces, Union Commander Robert Anderson surrenders Fort Sumter in Charleston Harbor. The attack marked what would later be considered the official start of the Civil War, a conflict which claimed more than 600,000 lives and fractured the nation close to the point of permanent dissolution. All because Confederates insisted on the right to enslave other human beings to run their plantations. And in 1964, Sidney Poitier wins the Academy Award for Best Actor for his leading man role in the film Lilies of the Field. His moving portrayal of a construction worker who helped build a chapel, capturing the hearts of millions. Poitier became the first African-American male actor to win the award. Hattie McDaniel won the Best Supporting Actress title 25 years earlier for her role as Mammy in the enormously popular film Gone with the Wind. People who drive through the scenic countryside of southeastern Pennsylvania know there are many streams and rivers cutting through the landscape. These waterways provided a valuable source of power for numerous colonial gristmills, paper mills, tanning mills, and other industrial enterprises starting in the early 1700s, many of which operated for nearly two centuries before being replaced by more sophisticated structures. The mill at Anselma, located along Pickering Creek in historic Chester Springs, Pennsylvania, dates back to 1747 and stands as the most intact, authentic, fully functioning water-powered grain mill in the United States, being placed on the National Register of Historic Places in the year 2005. On acreage originally owned by William Penn, the mill came to life as the need increased for quality flour to produce bread in the region. Chester County was the home for literally hundreds of grist mills, many located along the Brandywine and other rivers, which produced vital supplies for local citizens and even the Continental Army during the American Revolution. The area became known as the breadbasket of the colonies. The mill at Anselma welcomes visitors from April to December with a variety of exhibits, demonstrations, a lecture series, a farmer's market, and many other activities fun for the entire family. Neil Hobbins is the executive director of the mill at Anselma, and he's here to speak with us today. Neil, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Gene. Thanks for having me on today.
Oh, my pleasure. Exactly where is the mill at Anselma located?
The mill at Anselma is located on Route 401 in Chester Springs. We're about a half mile west of the Route 113 and 401 intersection. Our physical address is 1730 Conestoga Road.
Okay. I know from your website that the mill itself dates to about 1747. Are there any other older structures in the immediate area?
On our site, the oldest structure is probably our spring house. We kind of date that to the mid-1730s. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of the oldest building on our site. And then our mill is built in 1747.
Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about its history, pre-Revolution, during the war, afterwards, and who owned the mill?
Sure. All right. When the mill was built, it was built by Samuel Lightfoot, who was a pretty prominent surveyor at that time period. And throughout our history, we're going to have six families who own the mill. The longest being the Lightfoot family, who over the course of three generations owned and operated the mill for 65 years. Our last miller arrived in 1919, Mr. Oliver Collins, and he's going to own the mill for 63 years by himself. During the war, we're not sure the impact that it had, especially when Washington's army was in the area. But we do know that it operated as a grist mill to about 1933, 1934. And then after that, the building was used as different trades that Mr. Collins was doing, sharpening lawnmowers and running a woodworking and metalworking shop out of the first floor.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned Lightfoot, I think you said, who was a surveyor. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Yeah, I believe I read from your website that either he or someone else there at the mill actually kept some records from the famous Mason and Dixon, who did surveying in the region. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. In 1737 and by 1741, he's a deputy surveyor of Lancaster and Chester counties. And in 1738, he is given a grant from the King of England to help the Penn family draw a line, a border line between Pennsylvania and Maryland. There was a land dispute that was going on. And we seem to think that when 30 years later, when Mason and Dixon are conducting their surveying lines, that they're using Samuel Lightfoot's line from 1738 to kind of begin their that Pennsylvania portion of the Mason-Dixon line.
Now, did Lightfoot ever spend much time with Mason and Dixon? I mean, did you do any surveying with them? Or
that was something that myself and our miller, David Rollenhagen, we went to the archives this past winter and went through the original documents, and we can't say yes or can't say no. His name doesn't show up in the documents at all, but the Mason-Dixon expedition had a very large team of surveyors that were with them, so we can't exactly say yes or say no.
Mm-hmm. How large is the mill? And describe the structure and the grounds around it.
Sure. The mill is approximately 15 feet long by 30 feet wide, and it stands three stories high. It's very typical of your colonial stone structure that we see throughout Chester County with that beautiful Chester County stone. And it has a wood shingle roof. Inside the mill, there's three sets of stones. We have two French burr stones for grinding wheat and one feed stone for corn. In addition to the mill, we have 22 acres of beautiful wetlands and fields and woods on our property. And we have a spring house that dates to mid-1730s. Our night miller's house is from 1873, as well as a wagon barn. Visitors can walk along the railroad path from the old Pickering Valley Railroad, as well as we obviously have our mill pond and the mill races on our site.
Interesting. Now, I know there were literally hundreds of grist mills in the area. Tell us a little bit about the importance of grist mills to the economy of this region.
It's a very huge, huge importance that grist mills had to Chester County and specifically this region. And it's really during the colonial time period. There's grain shortages in England in the late 1730s through the 1740s and 1750s. And that makes a demand for the wheat and this flour from Chester County, Pennsylvania. And it kind of, from there, it helped really push this industry that was happening. By 1780, in 1747, when our mill was built, it's the only mill in Pikeland at the time, and that was both East and West Pikeland during the time. Hmm. But by 1780, there's eight mills just in our surrounding area.
Interesting. Now, were there any other mills along Pickering Creek?
Yes, there are. All through up and down the Pickering, there were grist mills. Sawmills. Later on, these sawmills and grist mills are being turned into textile mills. So they are up and down the Pickering Creek.
Mm-hmm. Many people don't realize especially if they haven't read much of colonial history, that Grist mills were some of the largest industrial enterprises of the time. I mean, they were quite substantial, and they produced necessary food. So, I mean, these are some of the earliest industries.
Certainly.
Mm-hmm. And so you mentioned wheat and corn. Were those the only grains that were ground there?
We also, on the records, we see oats and rye being ground here also. But early on, wheat is the main product that's being brought to the mill to be ground. And then once we see expansion west and they realize that it's much better to grow wheat in the Midwest, that's when we see corn kind of becoming the main product that's being produced mm-hmm. here, both for cornmeal and also corn feed.
Mm-hmm. I've never asked this of someone at a mill, but did the mill owners or workers ever make their own bread, or did they simply produce the flour and just ship it out?
Early on, especially in our mill, which was built originally as a custom grist mill, meaning that there wasn't a merchant quality to it, they would take a toll from the farmer's product that they would have. It usually was about 10%, and it would go into a toll bin. And that toll bin would be either for a farmer that might not have a wheat crop, but also used for that miller's family. And in fact, during the colonial time, I believe the typical person was consuming about a pound and a half of flour in the various forms that it would turn into bread a day.
Mm, interesting. How far did the mill ship its products?
We actually don't have any set records on how far their products were being shipped. What's interesting is in about 1825, 1826, our mill has the Oliver Evans system added in, and that's an automation process of a series of elevators that transports the grain throughout the mill. With that, and also we have a barrel packer on our second floor, those two things would not be added to a mill of our size without a merchant quality happening. So certainly with the addition of the railroad in the early 1870s, we're pretty sure that our products were being shipped to at least Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned Oliver Evans. He was one of the early inventors, one of the most important early inventors in the Industrial Revolution in America.
Certainly
I think he was important in a lot of different designs. How large was the output of the mill?
The records, we have 1870 records through the industrial census that was happening at that time. And it's John Oberholzer who's our miller during that period. And in 1870, he records that his output is 500 barrels of flour, which is roughly 10,000 pounds of wheat flour. But in addition to that, he's doing much more chop or feed corn-based product. He's doing about 4,100 bushels.
That's quite a bit, and I'm sure it fed all the local citizens who needed to purchase flour. The need for flour was immense, as people who could not grow their own crops, by definition, would have to buy that flour from somewhere, and that was probably one of the most important mills in the area. We are just about to take a commercial break, so please stay with us, and we will be right back after a brief break with Neil Hobbins of the Mill at Anselma.
Honey, we need a springtime getaway.
A springtime getaway. Somewhere with
amazing food.
Amazing food. And
cozy couples lodging.
Right, but not too far away or
Gettysburg.
Gettysburg.
Yep, Gettysburg.
Okay, but I want
award-winning golf
courses.
Horseback riding. A
Firkin
Festival.
How do you know all of this?
They have an app.
They have an app?
Yep, at destinationgettysburg.com.
So, Gettysburg.
Yep, Gettysburg.
Gettysburg, PA. Make your own history.
If you had to choose a roofer, would you choose one with limited experience and knowledge, or would you choose a roofer certified as a master elite contractor by the largest manufacturer in the nation, GAF, a distinction shared by only 3% of the nation's roofers? I'm talking about GP Martini Roofing, who also does siding, windows, doors, and offers an ironclad guarantee that he'll repair or replace any roof for defects within its normal life. GP Martini Services, Chester, Delaware, Bucks, and Montgomery counties, with free estimates and consultation, and does both commercial and residential. Go to the website at martiniroofing.com for special savings, or call 610-873-1696. And also, financing is available with no payments for a full year. Now, what roofer would you call? G.P. Martini is the answer, 610-873-1696.
If it's happening in Chester County, you'll hear about it here. WCAG 1520 AM, the talk of Chester County.
I'm Gene Pasale, and this is Living History. We're speaking with Neil Hobbins, the executive director of the Mill at Anselma in historic Chester Springs, Pennsylvania. Neil, the southeastern Pennsylvania region literally had hundreds of mills along its many fast-flowing streams, especially along the eastern branch of the Brandywine. How does the Mill at Anselma compare to in size and output to other local nearby mills?
Along the Brandywine, the majority of the mills that were located there were merchant mills in quality. In our area, like I said, by 1780, there were 8 mills locally around us. And at that time, we were the second to the smallest mill in the area.
Mm-hmm. Would it be fair to say that the Mill at Anselma was a pretty special place? Because, I mean, it has survived almost fully intact with refurbishments for, 270 years?
Certainly. It is. It's not only was a special place, but it still is a special place where it's really telling the story and the history of Chester County's industrial impact and its agricultural impact. We're very lucky that this landmark is still here to be able to tell that story.
Mm-hmm. I agree completely. And, you know, I visited several local grist mills. The mills along the Brandywine, or at least some of them, produced such high-quality flour, it was called Brandywine Superfine. You've probably done some research and seen that term used. How does the flour from Anselma compare to Brandywine Superfine?
We have our own Superfine, and it wasn't uncommon for millers to graffiti their mill. And our oldest graffiti dates to William Lightfoot, who was the miller between 1767 and 1797. And in fact, it's his W. Lightfoot stamp, and also underneath of that it says Superfine. So they were using that Superfine tag to show them the type of flour that was coming out of our mill also.
And so it was very high quality.
Yes, it was.
Aside from Mason and Dixon, were there any other famous personalities associated with the mill or the general area?
As far as we know, we don't have any records of any really nationally known figures in history that visit our mill. Lightfoot is one of our really heavy famous people that we like to attribute with the mill because of his impact on the local community. And also the Oberholzer family. John Oberholzer is kind of another rock star that we look at in our history with his impact of bringing the Pickering Valley Railroad. And really, he was the secretary, but he did so much more to bring that here, which kind of opens up the Anselma community in the 1870s and 1880s and 1890s. And also his wife, Sarah Louisa Oberholzer, is pretty famous in her. And she's a poet. She's brought in to speak at Valley Forge, at the Antietam Battlefield Commemoration in the 1880s, 1890s. She's also big into the women's rights movements, the school savings bank movement. So if there was one figure, it's probably Sarah, who is really the figure that is really making that national impact.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned earlier in a brief discussion about the Revolutionary War and the Continental Army under George Washington. I'm aware that when Washington was in the area before and even following the Battle of the Brandywine, I believe he made an order to many of the local mills to either take apart or destroy their mill wheels so the British would not get a hold of them. Do you have any evidence of that in your area?
We don't have any evidence of that. The impact that we see during the American Revolution, following the Battle of the Clouds, portions of Washington's army retreated to the intersection of present-day Route 100 and 113, and then went north on 113 to Yellow Springs, which is right around the corner from our location here. Mm-hmm. But we don't have any records that state that these troops visited our mill. Mm-hmm. And also during the Valley Forge campaign, we know that Washington's troops were sent out to and living in places like Downingtown and the local communities to forage and find these mills, and then they were to report to Yellow Springs, where Washington had his quartermaster department. Mm-hmm. But as far as any type of records, no, we don't have any records.
Mm-hmm. When did restoration activities begin on the mill at Anselma?
We look at two different time periods. So following our last miller's death, Mr. Collins' death in 1982, the French and Pickering Creeks Trust, really headed by Samuel and Eleanor Morris, took over the mill and ownership of the mill. And in the 1980s, they did kind of a program for mill stabilization, where they worked on the roof and the building. And then it wasn't again until 1999 where the Mill at Anselma Preservation and Educational Trust is established as a nonprofit. And from 2000 to about 2004, the main restoration began, where it's working on the machinery and the water wheel to get everything back to running again.
Mm-hmm. How much work was necessary to restore the mill to its former condition?
Quite a bit. It wasn't so much working on the gears. It was just kind of getting everything back up to be able to operate the mill. So there was minor work done to the hearse frame to stabilize the hearse frame, which holds all the machinery. The floor had to be redone. But all in all, it was quite a bit of work, but it was work that was just maintenance to have everything kind of dusted off, per se.
Are any of the parts of the mill still, I mean, the actual original, like the mill wheel, or are there any like 270 years old?
Certainly. And that's what really separates us from other mills that are still operational in our area. And it's one of the biggest reasons we're a National Historic Landmark, is that our wooden transmission system is still the original system, and we believe that our center burr stone is the original 1747 burr stone.
Oh, fascinating.
So a lot of the wooden gearing that's there is the original wooden gearing that's just had maintenance done throughout its history on it.
Mm-hmm. In terms of the refurbishment of the mill, I mean, I'm sure that was fairly expensive. Did you conduct any fundraising activities or special events to support that?
They did a combination of both, between fundraising activities and also auctions and benefits to be able to raise the money needed to support that restoration work.
Mm-hmm. You know, with the advent of steam power in the mid-1800s, water-powered mills started to decline in importance. How did this trend affect the mill at Anselma?
It doesn't affect our history at all, but where we do see our mill being impacted is in the early 20th century with the advent of portable mills, where that you could put it now on the back of a truck and transport it to the farmer's property, and you would be able to grind right there. And that's mm-hmm. ultimately what is the downfall of our mill.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that you're on the National Register of Historic Places. Did it take much effort or paperwork to get it onto the National Register?
Actually, we're actually a step above that. We're actually a National Historic Landmark, mm-hmm. and it does, especially to be a historic landmark, it takes a lot of effort, and it's something that we don't hold lightly. Part of becoming a landmark, you're asked to make sure that you tell the story and educate, and that's something that we take seriously to this day. We're constantly focusing on teaching about this mill.
Mm-hmm. You know, one thing that most people probably wonder about is, what does a mill do when you have a drought? I mean, I assume it just stops functioning. Is that right?
That's correct. And luckily, we haven't really had to deal with that. We don't mill even remotely close to how often our millers would have run it. We do have time periods where our water level is low and we're not able to do a production grind. But if the water wasn't there, the mill would not be able to run.
So. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, and going through the records as you have, were there many periods over the last, you know, 270 years that they showed in the written records that they just simply didn't have the water power to run the mill?
Luckily, no. That there's nothing that really shows up in our records to indicate that there wasn't enough water. In fact, when we look at our records, a mill pond really doesn't show up on our site until about 1870. It doesn't mean that it wasn't there before, but it's the first time that we notice a mill pond. So the Pickering was producing enough water early on that we didn't need to have this massive reserve pond.
Mm-hmm. Does the mill produce flour today for purchase?
We still do. We produce bread flour, pastry flour, dark roasted cornmeal, and buckwheat flour.
Excellent. Yeah, I'll have to stop by there. How many visitors do you get?
Last year we recorded just under 10,000 visitors, and that's visitors that are here for all of our different programs. We're open on a seasonal schedule, so we open in April, and from April till May, and then also September through December, we're open on Saturdays and Sundays from 10 to 4 for guided tours of the mill, and then from Memorial Day to Labor Day, we're open Thursday through Sunday.
What kind of special exhibits or displays do you have for visitors?
Every second Saturday of each month, we have our mill demonstration days, which also will have a special event associated with it. So visitors to the mill will be able to see the mill in fully operational, where we're producing feed for a local farmer in our area. And then at the same time, each month we have a different special event, whether it's our Colonial Children's Day, our Life in the 1860s, or our Civil War living history. So visitors not only get to experience the mill, but they also get to experience, through living historians, different parts of our history that have that played a role in the mill's history.
When visitors come to actually see the mill, can they get right up close to the, you know, the actual working of the mill, the grindstone and all that? Can they actually, you know, get within a few feet of seeing it work?
Yes, yes. And we're big with hands-on, so even for children, we like to run hands-on activities for them, whether it was shucking corn through the corn shucker. But, yes, visitors can get up real close and personal with the machinery and even see and touch the product that's coming out.
Do you get a lot of school groups?
We certainly do, and that's really, really important for us as an educational side. We do get quite a few school groups throughout the year, as well as adult groups.
Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about the lecture series. I'm sure you have various topics there.
We do. Our lecture series is held the first Thursday of each month from April through December, and it's a combination of mill history on our mill, and whether it's the families that lived here, and also we bring in outside lecturers to talk about local community around here. So next month we have Mr. Ryan Conroy of the Historical Society of Phoenixville coming to talk about the Irish in Phoenixville.
Oh, excellent. Excellent. What's the best time to visit the mill? I'm sure you get a lot of visitors around the 4th of July.
With me, I'm biased. I love fall to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
And then
me too.
The fall time period around here is just absolutely beautiful with the different colors of the trees.
Oh, sure.
And it really gives you a sense of that harvest time and how important it was for the millers during that time. But there's really no really bad season here, even during winter, mm-hmm. even though we're not open. There's different wildlife throughout the different times of the year and different mm-hmm. Flowers that bloom at different times of the year.
Oh, that's excellent. Well, for our listeners, you can go to anselmamill.org and see their website with a variety of exhibits and demonstrations and activities. Neil, thanks so much for joining us today on the show. Be sure to tune in next Wednesday, April 20th at 1 p.m. Eastern, when we'll be speaking with Sarah Winsky of the National Constitution Center in downtown Philadelphia. Thank you all for tuning into Living History.